Horace and Alira had left the chamber together, and by the light of a small lantern that Alira had brought, they made their way down a dark corridor. She clutched his arm with her other hand as they walked together. They arrived at a flight of steps. Alira started up, but Horace hesitated, suddenly not feeling well. He put a hand on his chest. He looked to Alira, so beautiful in the ethereal light. Now he had something to lose again, and it scared him to death.
Horace, are you all right?
Fine. I'm fine. Let's go.
They caught up with Lord Astapte at the top of the stairs. The vizier stood at the entry to a broad hallway with his head cocked slightly to one side, as if he were listening intently. Horace and Alira stepped up beside him without saying anything. Horace looked about, trying to determine their position inside the temple. Colorful frescoes decorated the walls and arched ceiling, illuminated by glowing orbs on bronze sconces. They were probably on the ground floor of the main temple structure, but the place was huge. They passed a side corridor down which Horace saw a high oriel window. By the hazy orange cast of the light coming in, it was almost sunset. Astapte stopped on the threshold of a large chamber. They had reached the temple's grand atrium. A cluster of temple guards stood with two red-robed priests in their midst. Astapte held up a black cube about the size of a chicken egg. Its sides gleamed with a mirror finish. Horace felt something emanating from it. He wanted to ask what it was. But Astapte threw the black cube into the chamber before he got the chance. It landed at the feet of the soldiers and exploded in a cloud of inky smoke. Tendrils of black shadow slithered out of the cloud to wrap around the legs of the temple guards. They were pulled into the smoke. Horace stepped into the atrium, but he froze when the nearest order sorcerer launched twin orbs of orange flame toward him. At the same time, the other sorcerer jabbed the air with a finger, and a line of pure white frost shot across the chamber. Acting out of instinct, Horace summoned his power and formed the emptiness of the Shinar into a hasty barrier in front of them. The fires and the icy rays struck at the same time, battering against the invisible bulwark. Smoke seeped around the edges, and spots of frost formed on the outer shell, but the barrier held.
Push through!
Astapte held something else in his fist, but Horace couldn't see what it was. Not sure what the vizier meant, Horace thrust out both hands. To his surprise, the barrier scuttled a few inches farther into the room. The black smoke remained, cloaking the majority of the atrium. Alira reached around his shoulder to point out one of the red robes sprinting toward the eastern end of the atrium.
Over there!
Horace attempted to separate the power maintaining his shield into two flows. It was something he had practiced with Molsivar, though not with much success. Expecting another failure, he was amazed when the Zoana divided into two channels. The barrier shook but held together while Horace shaped the second flow into the first thing he thought of, a rope. A lasso of flames lashed across the chamber from his open hand. The sorcerer, now almost to the wide doorway leading to the sanctum, turned and put up both hands, palms facing outward. Horace saw the counterspell before it landed and turned his left hand in a small circle. The fiery rope slipped past the sorcerer's outstretched hands and wrapped around his neck. The sorcerer stumbled forward, smoke rising from around his neck and both hands as he tried to pull the magical rope away. Horace jerked again, and the sorcerer fell on his face hard enough to knock himself out. He let the fiery cord evaporate, and panic seized him when the barrier fell as well. But Astapte pushed past him into the chamber, waving away the lingering smoke. Some of the soldiers were shaking their heads where they lay. A couple weren't moving at all. The other sorcerer knelt on the floor as his hands hovered over something small protruding from his stomach. Alira ran up and kicked him in the head. The sorcerer slumped. Horace hurried over.
You promised me you would stay behind.
He paused when she plucked the small object from the fallen magician and held it up. It was a long dart of silver metal.
It's a Wahedin. I had some friends make me a few of these.
Horace kept his distance from the potent throwing dart as he looked around the chamber. Four large doorways exited the atrium in the cardinal directions.
The ceremony will be on the west terrace.
Alira looked to the ceiling.
That's three stories above us.
Yes, and every approach will be guarded by members of the Order. The ceremony has begun. Do what needs to be done.
What about you?
I will stop anyone else from interfering. Go now, if you wish to save the Queen.
The vizier left them, heading across the atrium with long strides.
Are you ready?
Horace clasped Alira's hand, and they left the chamber together. More than 100 aristocrats arrayed in silk and glittering diadems crowded the western terrace of the Sun Temple. Emissaries from every city stood with the members of her court. They all turned to witness her entrance. Queen Byleth had spent the entire day being bathed, dressed, and made up. She wore the traditional bridal gown in gold, silk, and damask. Her hair was pinned up and festooned with a fortune in jewels. She might look like a goddess, but inside she felt like the biggest fool in the empire. She should have heeded Astapta's advice. She should have removed the Sun Cult from the city long ago when she had the chance. But she had chosen the path of patience, hoping to wait them out. Tomorrow, Aragosh would belong to the priests in all but name. She had failed herself and her people. She almost wished Lord Astapta were here now. She had met with him this morning with her final instructions before the sun rose. Whatever happened to her, she would not allow the storm engine to fall into the priesthood's hands. With much regret, she had commanded Astapta to dismantle his life's work and destroy all records of its existence. He had taken the news in silence and then departed her chambers for the last time. Theirs had been an odd relationship, tempestuous at times, but at the end she had to concede that he had been one of her most loyal servants. She did not envy his chances for survival once her new husband sat on the throne. As custom demanded, she arrived first to the altar with her train of attendants. Jantu stood beside her in the place of her ceremonial father, wearing a stern expression, but she knew him well enough to see the anxiety in the way he stood, the way he looked about, as if searching for an assassin. Thousands of citizens filled the temple grounds beneath the terrace. They were still Byleth's people for this moment, and she had loved them all her life. Four priests of the Sun Lord entered behind her, led by Kadamun. Menarch Ramesh followed him with two acolytes. Byleth glared at the envoy with every ounce of loathing inside her, which was substantial. His face was perfectly neutral, but she could imagine his smugness. He had beaten her. This wasn't her special day. It was his. The day he would make a queen of the blood grovel before the entire world. The Zoanna bubbled up inside her, wanting an outlet, and she was sorely tempted to unleash it. It wouldn't do her a bit of good, not with a dozen hounds of the Order seated among the honored guests, ready to pounce at a moment's notice. Everyone turned as Titanu stepped onto the terrace. The Prince of Nisus was resplendent in a coat of silver scales that shimmered like snakeskin in the failing daylight. Gold adorned the sword at his side, his fingers, and the large sunburst medallion hanging from his neck. Behind her groom marched an honor guard of famed Nisusi white sphinxes, soldiers of fearsome reputation for both their skill at arms and unwavering loyalty. Statuettes of their mythological namesake perched on the crests of their tall helms. The last members of the entourage were more priests, one from every faith, as was also traditional in a marriage of such high status. The final members, votaries of Nabu, the Keeper of Ancient Knowledge, closed the doors behind them as they entered. No one would be allowed to enter or leave until the ceremony was complete. While Byleth eyed the doors with a powerful desire to be on the other side, the prince came to stand beside her wearing a small smile, and her heart sank. His wasn't a smile of happiness or even of anticipated post-nuptial bliss. It was the self-satisfied smirk of a cat about to swallow the bird it had caught. The absurdity of the situation weighed down on her. She was standing in her own city, facing a man so much weaker in the Zoanna that she could kill him without much difficulty if she tried. But once their lives were joined in marriage, he would become her lord and master. She would be trapped for the rest of her life, which she presumed would be cut short unless she came up with some scheme. Pregnancy was the first thing to come to mind. Few men, especially those of the Zoanii class, would willingly give up the chance to have a legitimate son. If she conceived right away, that could buy her 9 months, and by the time she delivered, Kishar make it a son, she was confident she could have the prince wrapped around her finger. She had ensnared far more willful men into her web. High Priest Kadamun lifted a hand slowly to the height of his chest. His fingers shook a little as he intoned the blessing of the Sun Lord.
Homage to thee, O Lord of Light, he who sails across the sky, blessing all the world with his warmth. Watch over us, great lord.
Byleth found herself thrown against the hard granite altar block. A burning heat saturated her back through the thin material of her gown. She tapped into her Zoana and raised a ward of hardened air around herself as she twisted around. Where the doors to the temple had stood, now only an empty space remained. Their smoldering remains sagged on broken hinges amid a cloud of smoke. The stench of sorcery laced the air. Those witnesses who had not been knocked flat by the blast were quickly hurrying away from the sundered entry. Something flew through the smoke and landed on the terrace floor. It was a person wrapped in black rags. Byleth steadied herself as she peered closer. No, not black rags. Deep crimson robes like those worn by the men of the Order, seared nearly to charcoal. Her heart almost stopped as a tall figure stepped through the broken doorway, wisps of smoke curling around his shoulders. Horace squinted as he stopped inside the chamber. The rays of the fading sun shone upon a grand platform. The queen leaned against a stone altar beside her fiancé at the center of the terrace. The prince appeared aghast at the intrusion, while Byleth wore a look of bemused astonishment. Four priests, including Menarch Remesh, stood behind the altar with pained expressions, perhaps because of the smoking body of the Order sorcerer at their feet. Horus was about to shout for everyone to stand clear when the two younger priests by the altar stepped forward. Horus had only an instant to process the itching down his spine before twin attacks of jagged stones and freezing cold rushed at him. He braced himself for pain. Yet the sorcerer on the left threw back his head to reveal a thin shard of metal protruding from his neck, and his partner on the right jerked away with a similar dart through the meat of his hand. Both their magics dissipated into the air. Before either man could recover, Horus harnessed his Zoana, and a mighty gust of wind blasted both sorcerers, hurtling them both over the side of the terrace. The two older priests had already retreated behind the altar. As the pall lifted, soldiers with white figurines perched on their silver helmets pushed through the throng, and Horus got a glimpse of how many people were in attendance. More than 100, to be sure. Then he looked below and saw an ocean of faces filling the temple courtyard. He raised his right hand, open palm held out. The soldiers stopped at the front of the crowd, fingering their weapons as they watched him, but none advanced any closer. The Zoanii watched him as well with various expressions. Most appeared shocked, their eyes never leaving him. Horus started to beckon to the queen, his plan no more complicated than escorting her out of the temple. A sheet of brilliant white spray cascaded from the south end of the terrace, where another red robe pushed through the crowd. The nobles and soldiers in the path of the sparkling cone fell to the floor, covered in hoarfrost. Horus grabbed a lira and conjured a barrier just as the whiteness crashed over them. Spider webs of rime formed across the surface of the bulwark. Horus visualized a ray of fire shooting from his palm. Instead, three blazing spheres the size of apples zipped across the space. Two impacted on a frosty buckler shield conjured by the red robe with dull thumps, but the third sphere curved around the shield to strike the sorcerer in the forehead, dropping him to the floor. Horus prepared to fashion some kind of magical cage to hold the man down, but before he could act, a massive stone spike erupted from the terrace floor, impaling the fallen sorcerer through the back as it lifted him off the ground. Horus looked for the person responsible for the killing. At the altar, the venerable priest slumped to the floor with his eyes closed. There was no sign of Remesh. The queen and her betrothed glared at each other, but otherwise hadn't moved. Standing beside Byleth, Jantu glared at the bridegroom like he wanted to roast the prince over a slow fire. Then the bodyguard winked at Horus, and Horus swallowed his annoyance. It was over. The rest of the attendees and their soldiers didn't seem inclined to get involved. The queen was safe, and now they could get out of here. He was about to release a protective shield when Alira pointed upward, and Horus noticed for the first time the balcony above the terrace. Men stared down from the gallery, at least 20 of them, their crimson robes glowing darkly in the sun's dying light. Horus dragged Alira down to the floor and poured all his strength into the barrier. His knees had barely touched the floor stones when a powerful force smashed against the shield. A sharp pain ripped down the center of his head. Horus didn't want to look, but he forced himself to as Alira tensed against him. Wedding guests lay all about him, their limbs and torsos contorted in sickening positions. With an ache in his stomach, he realized they had been crushed. He held Alira close as his barrier was pummeled as if by 1,000 invisible sledgehammers. They were trapped. Eventually, his mystic barrier would fail. They would both die. A stream of blood ran from under the pile of crushed bodies. Horus squeezed his eyes shut. But the darkness brought no reprieve from the images cascading through his mind. He stood once again on the deck of the Sea Spray. His family was safe from the plague consuming the city of Tynes. Horus shaded his eyes and viewed his dying town. He whirled around as the burning schooner in the next berth lurched as its foremast broke loose from its moorings. The tall pole fell like an axed tree. His family disappeared under a mountain of flaming wood and rigging. He leapt toward the inferno, digging at the fiery debris with his bare hands as a trickle of blood ran along the deck.
Sorry! Joseph!
Horus!
Warm wetness touched Horus's fingers. He looked down to see the rivulet of blood had touched his hand. He watched it pool around his fingers, running against his old burn scars. He could still remember being on his hands and knees on the deck of the Sea Spray, digging through the burning sailcloth and rigging while his wife and son were dying. If he hadn't taken his family aboard that ship, they might still be alive today. It was his fault they had died. If he was any kind of man, he would have thrown himself into the flames after them. Better to die that day than live with this shame. Horus hauled himself to his knees, the agonies of his past and the icy fire of the Zoanna fusing together in the blazing furnace behind his breastbone. A tracery of tiny cracks ran through the barrier as he delved into the gray space inside him, gathering up every bit of magic he could summon. He lashed out. Forks of green lightning flashed from his hands. The Shinar Dominion pulsed within him while the energy poured out, seemingly without end. Skin blistered and blackened as the emerald bolts raked across the gallery. Crimson robes burst into flames. The enemy sorcerers fell in droves. The soldiers on the terrace rushed toward Horus, but a gust of frosty wind sent them tumbling back. The Queen and Jantu pushed them back with alternating blasts of wind and multicolored flames. As the last sorcerer fell from the balcony, Horus released the power. Alira stood beside him. Spots of soot smudged her face, but she had never looked more beautiful. In that moment, he realized he could let go of his past. He was free, though an empty hole remained inside him. He was about to reach out to Alira when Byleth strode toward them.
You astound me yet again, Lord Horus.
I was merely repaying a debt owed, Your Excellence.
Just remember, you are my champion.
Horus started to reply when he caught a glimpse of movement from over his shoulder. He turned in time to see a man in a yellow robe dart out the ruined doorway. Ramesh. Horus reached out with his power, intending to seize the priest in a grasp of solid air, but the power slid off without slowing him. Horus grasped Alira's hand.
Accompany the queen back to the palace.
He couldn't tell which of the two women was more taken aback by his command, Alira or Byleth. Both stared at him with odd expressions.
Please.
Then he took off after the Menarch.
Where are you going?
Horus kept running. He squinted as he ducked through the ruined doorway after Menarch Ramesh. Several doors opened along the corridor, but as he moved down the passageway, an impulse tugged at him, drawing him toward a small door farther down. He pushed it open. Inside, glowing orbs on the walls illuminated a narrow corridor of dressed stone. He sprinted down the hallway. As he followed the corridor around a corner, Horus tried to ignore his shaking hands. The Zoanna lent him strength and clarity, but it also put his nerves on edge. He stopped in his tracks as he entered a large chamber with a very high ceiling. A massive golden effigy, 20 feet tall, dominated the room. The statue was of a muscular man on a throne, holding a spear in one hand and a fiery ball in the other. Golden flames radiated from his high crown. This could be none other than the sun god of the Acheshians. The thing looked like it was made of solid gold, but he couldn't believe that. The cost would have been beyond imagining. On the other side of the chamber, he found a stout wooden door, but it was locked. There was no keyhole, and he didn't have a key anyway, so it didn't matter. The door felt solid enough to withstand anything less than a battle axe. He didn't have one of those either. Reaching out with his power to the door's stone frame, Horus winced as the effort became slightly painful. Gritting his teeth, he tried harder until he was rewarded with the familiar rush of energy. Cracks appeared as the stone frame flexed. A hard kick swung the door open, with pieces of the lock mechanism flying off. The chamber beyond was smallish, about 10 feet on each side, with tall cabinets against the far wall. A quick look inside revealed a case of ascending stone steps. Horace charged up them two at a time. Just as he reached the first landing, a familiar tickle itched down his spine. He jumped back just before the wall in front of him exploded in a rain of shrapnel. He looked up in time to see a heavyset man in red robes escaping around the next turn of the stairs. Fists clenched, he ran after him. He rounded the next turn a little more cautiously and wasn't surprised when a rock the size of his head flew just inches in front of his face. It hit the wall beside him and caromed down the stairs. Horace erected a barrier of solid air in front of him as he edged around the corner. Isiratu stood on the landing above. Blood dripped from a deep gash down the side of his neck, but the former nobleman didn't seem to mind it as he raised his hands. Horace glimpsed something falling from the ceiling, a heartbeat before a huge piece of stone crashed down on him. His shield collapsed, holding just long enough to deflect the stone so that it missed his head by a few inches. Startled, Horace opened himself to the Mordab Dominion and tried to fashion a ball of ice, hoping to distract or at least slow down the former Zoanii, but instead a cold mist filled the stairway. He threw himself against the wall as Isiratu made another gesture. Another large stone dropped from the ceiling to shatter on the steps between them. Lord Molsabar had said that a master of the Shinar Dominion was a master of all the Dominions. It was time to test that theory. Horace opened his ka to the Kishargul Dominion. His earlier exhaustion faded as a new strength seeped into his veins. He was suddenly aware of the stone around him, the walls, floor, and ceiling, as well as the many chips of stone scattered on the stairs. With a thought, he lifted the small pieces of rock and sent them flying up at his foe. Isiratu raised his arms to protect his face, the sleeves and front of his robe shredding from the onslaught, and Horace pressed his attack. Isiratu motioned with one hand, and chunks of stone tore loose from the stairway walls. But Horace shattered them with his thoughts one by one as he climbed the steps. Isiratu's face had turned purple. Blood streamed down the front of his robe from the Immaculata on his neck, but he continued to fight. More rocks flew at Horace from every direction as he kept climbing toward his foe, but not a one touched him as he discovered he didn't have to shatter them all. Just by altering their paths by a couple of inches, he could force them to swerve around him. Isiratu lifted both arms to the ceiling. Larger blocks of stone rained down, but they curved away from Horace to strike the steps behind him.
Why did you have to stay in Aragosh? Why couldn't you leave me alone?
He reached out with his Zoanna and exploded a slab of stone as it fell. Bits of shattered rock showered over Isiratu. Horace launched a blast of air and shoved the former lord back across the landing. Isiratu struck the far wall, pressed there by the powerful wind, as new Immaculata spread across his face.
I would have let you go. Even after the pit, I would have let you live. But you won't stop until one of us is dead.
Isiratu reached for the ceiling, and a tremor raced through the steps under Horace's feet. Cracks sprouted in the walls, spewing dust into the air. Horace braced himself for a knockout punch. Then the rain of stone ceased. Isiratu stood rigid, his eyes wide and bloodshot. Blood from his Immaculata gushed from his neck and poured down the front of his robe. Then he slumped against the bands of air holding him upright, his life extinguished. Horace looked upon the man who had delivered him over to the temple, now dead by his hand, and wondered if this ending had been destined to happen from the very first moment they met. He severed his connection to the magic and stepped over Isiratu's body. He wasn't finished yet. The stairs took him up several more stories. Horace's knees ached by the time he arrived in a large, open-sided chamber at the apex of the temple. Cyclopean stone pillars at each corner held up the domed roof, the interior of which was painted in a breathtaking mural of the Akeshian Pantheon amid a starry sky. Horace peered around for the Menarch. There was nowhere else he could have gone. Ramesh stepped out from behind the southeastern pillar holding a long dagger. Its bare blade shone in the starlight.
I thought my mission was to purge the city of its sins and bring it under the protective aegis of Amur. But then I learned of you, and I realized the corruption went deeper. You are no mere savage. You are a cancer lodged in the city's breast, spreading your destructive influence to everyone and everything you touch. And the only way to stop your menace is to cut you out.
It's over. The queen is returning to the palace, unwed and still in power.
For today. But tomorrow or the day after, or next week, my order will have its way. The gods have spoken.
The gods? No. A sect of old men who want to rule the Empire.
And you? You are an abomination conceived in chaos. It would have been better for the world if your mother had strangled you the day you were born.
I never asked for this. But now that I've...
Horace fell on his side as a blast of freezing wind threw him to the floor. Two red robes came out from behind other pillars, flinging sorcery ahead of them. Horace rolled away from a jet of blue flame. And back to his feet. Ramesh had vanished. Horace sent a barrage of fiery embers at the sorcerers. The gusting wind scattered the embers, and more tongues of flame lapped at him. Horace reached for the Kishargul Dominion again and imagined his hands grasping the stones of the floor. With a mental yank, he pulled up a dozen flagstones and threw them at the red robes. One sorcerer pushed out with his hands, but the stones tore through his shield of wind and slammed into him. Blood spurted as the sorcerer fell on his back, sharp edges of stone protruding from his body. The other red robe flung himself away in time to avoid the deadly missiles. Horace sent a bolt of hardened air after him, but the sorcerer ducked behind a pillar before it found him. Horace approached the southeastern pillar looking for the Menarch, but the space behind it was vacant. A stone balustrade bordered the edge of the terrace overlooking the city. Horace was turning around when a vice of air seized him around the middle and lifted him off the ground. All of a sudden, he became very aware of the great fall that waited over the side of the balcony. Across the chamber, two more red robes were coming up the stairs. One held out a clenched fist like he was squeezing an orange. Unable to draw breath, Horace delved inside himself for a solution, but his grasp on the Dominions seemed to fray. Only his connection to the void held steady. He grabbed onto it like a lifeline. An inclination passed through his mind, cutting through his desperate struggle to survive. If he would just do this, then... Visualizing a huge sword, Horace invoked the emptiness welling inside him. The power sliced down through the space between him and the approaching sorcerers. Suddenly, the force holding him evaporated, and he fell almost a full body length to the floor, landing hard with both feet and staggering a step before catching himself on the balustrade. New attacks rained down on Horace, pelting him with fire and ice and battering winds, but nothing got through the invisible barrier of Shinar energy he had erected. With a thought, he bent the barrier until it enclosed him on all sides. A sense of security enveloped him as his enemies continued to batter his sanctuary without success. He then stepped away from the guardrail. He conserved his strength and didn't counterattack as he advanced toward his enemies. Then two more Order sorcerers appeared from the stairway and joined their brethren. Their robes were fresh and pristine, not yet marked by signs of battle. The addition of the new sorcerers halted Horus's advance. As their magical bombardment continued, Horace opened a pathway to the Mordab Dominion and targeted one of the new arrivals. A cloud of water vapor appeared around the sorcerer and quickly froze, encasing him in ice. He turned his attention to another assailant and launched a flurry of icy orbs at his next target.
Who are you to defy the Empire? No one will mourn your death. You are an insect before the power of Amur. Insignificant! Meaningless!
A beam of moonlight shone into Horace's eyes, making him blink. The full moon hung over the city. Its heavenly beauty stirred a memory in the back of his mind. It took him a moment to realize what it was. The innermost circle of Mulcibar's Ganzermat. Horace blocked out everything else as he concentrated, the rest of the design coming to him. He could see it now, a picture of perfection with all of creation contained within its many-hued borders. Everything that existed was represented in the Ganzer. From the sky and stars to the earth below and every creature under heaven. Everything was connected. He existed everywhere in the universe, and all the universe existed within him. His family was still with him, too. As long as he breathed, his love for them would never die. As above, so below. He opened the gates of his Ka. Warm tremors radiated through his body, not the hot flashes that the Zoana usually sent into his veins, but a deeper, more powerful sensation. The designs throughout the Ganzer in his mind danced in 10,000 colors, each etched in argent moonlight, merging and separating as if they moved to some music he couldn't hear. Sweat trickled down his face as he poured his energy into the effort. Something exploded against his barrier with the brightness of the sun. Sharp pain ripped through his chest. His eyes shot open. The moon was gone, replaced by a bank of thunderheads flickering with emerald green light. He winced when the first bolt of lightning struck the temple. The second bolt hit the dome overhead. One of the stone ribs holding up the ceiling broke loose. Two sorcerers disappeared under an avalanche of rock and broken mortar. The entire floor of the chamber shook, but Horace kept his attention focused on the image in his mind. His exhaustion had fallen away, and the dark fog that had clouded his thoughts for so long was gone.
Bring him down!
More lightning lanced down into the city. The thunder shook more stones loose from the ceiling. The dome was fracturing, its support pillars weakening as the massive weight shifted. Rain blew in sideways and patterned on the smooth tiles. Horace concentrated on the white circle in the center of his mental ganzer. He looked out to the rolling storm clouds. The connection he always felt with the chaos storms remained just beneath the surface of his consciousness.
Is that the key?
The storms and his power, they were linked somehow. He stared into the white circle, intent on discovering its secret. The way it remained steady while the other designs danced around it almost reminded him of the eye of a storm. Horace did the first thing that came to mind. He flung open his pathway to the Shinar Dominion and pulled with all of his will. Dazzling light filled the open chamber. Power beyond anything Horace had handled before came to him as the storm's energy shot through it. The moment seemed to last forever as he soaked in more and more energy. His ka yawned open like a bottomless pit. Then it was over. His legs gave out and he fell to his knees on the wet flagstones. Then he realized his mystic barrier was gone and panic washed over him. He looked up, ready to continue the fight, but the sorcerers were all down on the floor. Scorch marks covered their bodies, their robes burned to ash. Ramesh, his robes soaked and streaked with black soot, appeared from behind a pillar. The dagger gleamed in his raised fist as he charged. Horace launched what he intended to be a bolt of fire at Ramesh, but the flames curved around Ramesh without touching him. Horace fell backward. He blocked the Menarch's wrist with his forearm, and the blade sliced across his upper arm instead of his throat. Horace kicked upward, and his instep connected with Ramesh's groin. Horace tried to shove the priest away, but Ramesh was stronger than he looked. Then he noticed a chain dangling from the Menarch's neck. On the end of it swayed a metal circle with twisting symbols engraved into its surface. He recognized the silvery alloy at once and knew why his magic had failed him. He grabbed Ramesh's wrist as the dagger came down again. The Menarch leaned over him, and Horace braced himself for the next thrust. A fresh splash of blood showered down on him. Blinking it away, Horace looked up. Ramesh glared down at him, his face a rigid mask with the hilt of a knife protruding from his neck. Then the priest toppled over. Alira's mouth was a grim line as she pulled her knife free, but her lips turned up in a faint smile as she reached down her other hand to Horace.
I had a feeling you might need some help.
Alira shoved her shoulder under Horace's armpit and lifted. With her help, he managed to get back on his feet.
What are you doing here? I told you to see the queen out of the temple.
Her Majesty is on the way back to the palace. Oh, Horace, this wound is severe.
She placed her fingers on the wound in his forearm.
Can you feel that?
Don't do that again. Listen to me. The ceilings.
A large piece of masonry hit the floor on the north side of the chamber.
Get out of here!
Not without you!
Alira steered Horace back to the staircase. By the time they reached the grand atrium, it felt like the entire temple was coming down. Alira pulled him out the tall doors. The sky was pitch black. Stinging rain pelted their faces as they ran toward the main gate of the complex. Stones fell all around them, massive chunks of masonry that smashed through the paved stones and lodged deep in the earth. They reached the gate, which had been left ajar. They staggered out onto the street and turned to look behind them. The temple's upper half had sloughed away, spilling across the courtyard in a long pile of rubble that reached to the outer boundary walls of the complex. Horace couldn't believe his eyes, nor the fact that he had been responsible for such destruction. He thought of the pits beneath the temple's foundation and wondered how many unfortunate souls were trapped down there. But there was nothing he could do for them.
We should go.
With a nod, Horace started toward the palace with her. Lightning crackled above the city, showing with every illuminating flash that they were the only ones insane enough to be out in the storm. The white expanse of the desert undulated in an endless sea, shimmering silver and gold with the first rays of dawn. Jaram sat atop a pile of boulders, holding the Capicul's sword across his lap. The rebels had marched west most of the night to reach this place, which Emanon had described as a safe harbor. A small cave mouth led down to a hollow den beneath the boulders. Jerome had tried to lie down inside, but it had been too much like a tomb, and so he came out for some air, while the grateful sentry left on guard duty retired inside. As he watched the sun come up, Jerome wondered about the things beyond his sight. He wondered about the men he'd lost at Omicur, whether they'd be buried with funeral rites or be left to the jackals. He wondered about the defenders and how many of them had died in that hellhole. Mostly, he wondered about a man still back in the Queen City.
I swore I would get him out, but now I'm farther away than ever and getting farther with every step I take.
Jerome saw Emanon's head pop up from the cave. The captain climbed up beside him on the rocks. Emanon's new beard accentuated his devilish good looks. Jerome was tempted to speak first, to say something witty or ironic, but he held his peace. Silence had always worked best for him when it came to men.
I thought I'd find you out here.
Emanon gestured to the rising sun.
It's pretty, eh?
Jerome gazed at the sky. He'd spent the past couple of hours thinking about what to say to this man, but now he was unsure how to begin. Emanon gestured to the Asurana sword.
That's blood steel, a mixture of Zuahadin and red gold. There's only a handful of smiths in all the Empire who know that recipe. That blade is worth a small kingdom.
So what happened to your secret army?
They're out there, waiting for the next phase.
And what's that?
I think you already know.
I suspect I do. The Queen's legions were bloodied but not crushed, isn't that right? And there will be more dog soldiers to replace us. So what's left but to hide out here?
You think we're running?
Aren't you?
There's more than sand and scorpions out here, Jerome. The desert is freedom. The desert is shelter from our enemies.
A lot of men die in the desert.
Aye, that they do. But others grow stronger. Like a certain former gladiator I know. We'll stay here and gather our strength, and then go out to find some friends.
Why not just go? Leave Akeshia for good. You're free.
Because Omicur wasn't the end, Jerome. It was the beginning. All across the Empire, slaves are gathering in secret, waiting for a sign. We will be that beacon, calling them to throw off their iron chains and reclaim their liberty.
I have to go back to Eregash.
You really want to die that badly? You may as well dig yourself a hole right here and let the desert swallow you up. It'd be a lot less painful.
I can't abandon Horus. From what little we've heard,
it sounds like her fucking majesty has her claws sunk into him deep. You know, he's probably already dead, too.
Mayhap, but I couldn't live with myself if I didn't try to help him.
Jerome, why is this man so important to you? Is he... Damn it, do you love him?
Jerome braced himself for rejection, ridicule, or even violence. But he saw instead in Emanon's eyes something he had rarely seen. Understanding.
I'm sorry, but I couldn't let you leave without telling you how I feel about you. Do you love this Horus?
No. We went through a lot together. You understand what that does.
Then stay with us. We'll get your friend out. I haven't forgotten my promise.
When?
The time will come, and we'll be there to make it happen. But going back alone is crazy. Our former masters don't have a sense of humor when it comes to escaped slaves.
I have to try.
All right. Then I'm going with you.
No. You have an army to lead. These people are relying on you.
And I need your help for that to succeed. I didn't get these men out by myself. You're a big part of this operation, Jerome. I can't do it without you.
You promise you'll make every effort to free Horus?
I swear it.
Then if I'm staying, I have a few ideas.
Ideas? Like what?
Like some changes that need to be made around here, starting with unit discipline. These men are too soft.
Too soft? They survived the training camp, didn't they?
Surviving isn't enough.
All right, come inside. I'll show you what I'm planning.
Thank you.
The sun had risen through a crystal blue sky, searing away all traces of the rain from the previous night. Horace stood on the balcony of his bedchamber and gazed across the cityscape. Reminders of the storm remained in the burned-out homes and devastated gardens, some of them littered with stony debris from collapsed retaining walls and fallen buildings. Yet the streets were already bustling with people, merchants and workers, silk-curtained palanquins and servants in fine livery. When they had reached the palace last night, a contingent of soldiers escorted him and Alira to the queen's chambers. As the royal physicians looked Horace over, Byleth had made him an offer.
Nothing can convey the depths of my gratitude, Lord Horace. But there is one thing in my power that means as much to you. Your freedom. You can leave Erugash at any time and take with you a document in my own hand, giving you permission to travel wherever you want. There is an invader stronghold on the Etonian border. You could be there in a couple of weeks.
Horace hadn't known what to say, and so he'd said nothing at all. After the doctors finished stitching him up, he and Alira went back to his manor house. The servants and guards who had survived the attack welcomed them home with broad smiles. After sleeping like a dead man, he awoke in the early morning hours to feelings of emptiness. He had wandered out to the terrace to think. If the queen could be believed, he could go back to Arnos or rejoin the crusade. With what he had learned over the past couple of months, he could give his people a fighting chance.
But a chance to do what? Conquer these lands? Sack Erugash? And then what? People will die, a few rich men will become richer, and the Akashians will have to rebuild. Is that what these powers were meant for?
In the past, he might have turned to prayer when wrestling with a weighty problem, but the idea of going down on his knees right now seemed wrong.
Did the Almighty save me from the sea and the wrath of the Akashians? Or did I save myself? Is this magic a gift or a curse? And where do I really want to be? Who do I want to be with?
The bedroom door opened. Alira joined him with a covered tray in her hands.
Hungry?
Let's eat out here.
Alira brought out chairs and placed the tray on a table between them. The dish was a blend of eggs and goat cheese cooked into a funnel shape and stuffed with vegetables from the garden. Despite being hampered by an injured shoulder, Horace surprised himself by eating his half voraciously.
Do you want to talk about last night?
I feel 100 years older this morning. I'm exhausted. I can't sleep another wink. There's so much spinning around in my head.
Like what?
I had a dream that we left Mulsabar entombed down in those pits under the temple.
You did what you could, Horace.
Did I? I brought down an entire temple on top of him. He was a good man, and now he's buried under a mountain of stone.
Horace, Lord Mulsabar played a very dangerous game. He knew the risks, but he followed his conscience. You are not to blame for what happened. You didn't start this war, but you did as much as anyone could to end it. What else?
What?
You said you had a lot of things on your mind. What else?
Well, us. You and I. Do we have a future together?
Is that what you want?
Yes. There's nothing for me back in Arnos. This is my home now. I'm still the Queen's first sword. A man with ambition could go far.
Or end up in an early grave.
A man might be willing to risk that, if he had the right woman by his side.
Horace, I don't know about...
I lost my wife and son in a fire. Tynes had been hit with a plague. Everyone was panicking. I got us passage out on a boat, but there was fighting and a fire broke out and I saw them die right in front of me. I saw...
That's where you got these scars on your hands.
I've been lost, Alira. For so long. It's like I've been sailing across an ocean with no land in sight.
I know how that feels. I was lost too. Then I became an agent and things seemed to get better. But that fear never really went away. I can still feel it. Maybe we could...
Alira hurried to the door, wiping her eyes with the backs of her hands. One of Horace's guards, Gorita, stood in the doorway.
There is a message, my lord.
The guard held out a wooden tube, both ends capped with wax plugs.
It came by courier. No name was given.
Thank you, Gorita.
Alira brought the tube to Horace. He broke off one of the end caps and slid out a rolled tube of papyrus. It was crisp, as if freshly pressed. He glanced at Alira as he unrolled it. Horace read the fine, precise script in Arnasi, with Alira reading over his shoulder.
My friend Horace, I hope you will permit me to think of you as a friend, for I have few these days, and I think that you and I have much in common. We are both men out of our natural element, thrust into positions of power we never desired. You, I think, adapted better than I have. Certainly better than anyone expected. This message will reach you sometime after my death or disappearance, and I'm afraid it contains few words of hope. By now, you must have some sense of the troubled waters you are navigating. I fear that an old enemy has come prowling at the Empire's gates. The Queen will need your strength, for though she is a goddess in the flesh, she is not infallible. May the gods not punish an old man too harshly for writing such blasphemy. But as your influence grows, so too will the list of powerful people who wish for your downfall. The ear of the Queen comes with a high cost. Guard yourself always and learn whom you can trust. Be faithful and steadfast, and never fear to tell her the truth. I will pray for your longevity and your success. Your friend, Mulsebar Faratun Etalulu. And forgive Lady Alira. Despite her mixed loyalties, she has always been the very model of grace and constancy.
That Faker! All this time he knew!
Horace considered the message. If he was really staying in Aragosh, then things were going to get more dangerous, not less.
Thank you for everything, old man. I wish we'd had more time together. And I hope you find contentment in whatever heaven your gods have made for you. So, you were saying something about the two of us.
I was?
I'm just gonna say this. You can stay here as long as you like, but I won't hold you back if you want to leave.
I'd like that.
Well, it's decided then.
All right.
Horace went to the balcony edge and leaned against the railing, taking in the sights and smells of the city. It was his home now. Alira came up beside him and they looked out over the rooftops together, watching the shadows vanish as the sun rose higher in the bright Akeshian sky. Horace knew what he needed to do now.
My father was a shipwright for the Crown. After I graduated from the university at Altava, I followed in his footsteps, working first at the company of Lagford and Sons and later forming my own shipbuilding business. I met Sari and we married within a year, and Joseph came along soon after that.
The glowing orb in the center of the ceiling flickered with a pale light, giving off just enough illumination to show the four walls of the small cell. Mulsebar lay naked on a stone slab, except for a breechclout, strapped down with Zoahadin bands and unable to move. He reached for his Zoana for the 100th time since he'd awakened here, a little more than a day ago by his best reckoning, and felt nothing. The vizier entered and closed the door behind him. Mulsebar got a glimpse of the rough stone corridor outside, but nothing else.
Greetings, Lord Mulsebar.
Is the Queen alive?
Indeed, Her Majesty is in fine health, thanks to myself and your apprentice.
So the Minarch's plot failed?
Was there ever any doubt?
The Stopter went to a metal shelf beside the head of the stone table and fiddled with something.
It is not yet time for the lovely Byleth to leave the throne. But don't fret.
The Stopter came over to the slab with a long metal hose in his hand. It was segmented like an earthworm and flexible. Three steel prongs jutted from the open end. The vizier leaned over him.
I will keep the Queen safe until it is her time to experience my creation in a more personal way.
The Stopter placed the pronged end of the hose against Mulsebar's forehead, where it attached itself. The pain was excruciating, as if the hose was sucking out Mulsebar's brain matter. No, not his brains, his Zoana. He felt the power flowing out of him into the mouth of the hose. His eyes darted to Astapta, but the vizier was leaving.
No! Come back!
Astapta turned.
I have other clients to attend to. You are part of a glorious enterprise. One that will elevate this humble soul to such heights of power that even the gods will look on with envy.
The vizier went out and closed the door behind him once again. The Book of the Black Earth is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2014, John Sprunk. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2014, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download or duplication is prohibited. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Thomas Keegan, Nora Ashrati, Colleen Delaney, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, Christopher Sheeran, Andy Clements, Tim Getman, Bradley Smith, Christopher Walker, Michael John Casey, David Jordan, James Lewis, John Dow, Richard Rowan, Scott McCormick, Jeff Allen, Kimberly Gilbert, Alyssa Wilmoth, Steve Wanall, David Coyne, Nanette Savard, Scott Graham, James Konacek, Drew Kopas, Dylan Lynch, Rose Elizabeth Supan, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Book adapted for graphic audio by Doug Krenzlin. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by John Glennon. If you enjoyed The Book of the Black Earth, be sure to look for Simon R. Green's Forest Kingdom Saga and Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn series, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, audio guides, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in graphic audio. The Forest Kingdom and the neighboring Kingdom of Redheart are on the brink of war, in spite of all efforts to avoid it. The only hope seems to be a royal marriage.
Father, what have you done?
I have an important announcement to make, and it is necessary that you be here to hear it.
Why wasn't I told about this in advance?
It is my pleasant duty to announce this day that a marriage has been arranged between Princess Catherine of Redheart and Prince Richard of the Forest Kingdom.
What?
Redheart and the Forest Kingdom have been arguing over the same stupid stretch of borderland for decades.
The Forest Kingdom has agreed to give up all claims to a large area of the disputed territories. Not all, but enough. In return for a guaranteed border.
They've given us something, so I have to give them something. I'm giving them you, Catherine, my dearest daughter.
But there is a force larger than kings moving events forward. A malevolent power with a thirst for blood and a grudge against the mysterious heroes Hawk and Fisher and their family.
Did you really think you could escape your past just by running away to another land to become someone else? Did you really think you could ever be forgiven for what you did? No, it's time for you to die. Your grandchildren are in danger. They will die slowly and horribly unless you return to the Forest Kingdom to save them. A war is coming. The darkness is rising. The blue moon is coming back. And you and I will play the game of fate and destiny one last time. Stop me, my dear ones, if you can.
We had a visitor. The Demon Prince.
The Demon Prince? Really?
Like in the stories from our childhood? I mean, I've read the histories, but...
Raven, Mercy, he threatened you two, specifically.
Thank you for coming back. For us.
Family is family. Anyway... The Demon Prince also gave us a warning, or a prophecy. He said there would be war.
The Darkwood is growing again, and the demons are returning. Prince Richard must take up the fight, just as Prince Rupert and Princess Julia had done generations ago to rid the forest of the Demon Prince and his minions. But how?
I need to test myself against the Darkwood, to see if I'm made of the same stuff as my ancestor.
You go in there on your own, you'll never come out again.
Hell with that! You think I'd let you two hog all the fun? They'll write songs about us for this.
Damn. That was bad. I mean, that was really bad. Nothing like what I was expecting.
It was awful! Not just night, not just darkness, more like the complete absence of everything.
I'm sorry. I should never have done that to you.
Richard's problem is he's still young enough to think that something will always turn up at the last moment to solve the problem and save the day.
Is this a dream?
Of a sort. I live in dreams now. The dream of the land. I have returned, Richard. After so many quiet years in the forest, because I'm needed. Because the forest needs me. Because the Demon Prince walks the land again.
In the Darkwood?
No. But you've been to the Darkwood, haven't you? I can see its mark upon you, body and soul. My dear Richard, beware. Destiny has you in its grip.
That destiny brings Prince Richard and his bride Catherine face to face with the legendary Hawk and Fisher and their descendants, who return to the Forest Kingdom to defend the land they love and battle the Demon Prince himself back to the grave and beyond. Don't miss Simon R. Green's culmination of the Forest Kingdom saga, Once in a Blue Moon, now available in graphic audio.
Graphic Audio presents Simon R. Green's Ghost Finders.
Everybody knows there are bad places in the world.
We're not alone. There's something here with us. No visible presence. Can't say I actually heard or smelt anything. There's definitely a sense of being observed, and not in a good way.
As the world changes, so do the way in which we see ghosts.
Something's down here with us, and it's not anything I expected. This isn't like anything we've ever encountered before, people. This is something new. Or maybe something very old come round again. Big and powerful and utterly different.
From dark shapes in the night and ancestral revenants, to lovers separated too soon and thwarted enemies. From stone tape recordings and electromagnetic phenomena, to men and women caught in repeating loops of time like insects trapped in amber. Ghosts have always been with us, like guests reluctant to leave the party, like bad memories that just won't go away.
Come on, JC, you're feeling this too, I can tell. Like ice in your blood, knives at your throat, like something really bad could come charging out of that tunnel mouth at any moment, and for everything you feel, it's 1,000 times worse for me. Who's afraid of the big werewolf, JC? I am.
Ghosts are nightmares of the past, refusing to give way to the present. Mankind's dark side. Humanity's unconscious, England's dreaming. And so, in this brave new 21st century, don't expect ghosts to be limited to old manor houses or abandoned rectories. Of course, not all ghosts are dark forces intent on humanity's ruin. Some are just poor lost souls trying to find their way home. And they can be the most dangerous of all.
I feel so cold and alone.
You're not alone anymore. I'm here. We're all here to help you. I'm JC.
I'm Kim. I shouldn't be here, should I?
We are the Carnacki Institute. Agents trained and armed to stand between humanity and all the forces of the afterworlds. Now, are you going to leave quietly, or are we going to have to give you a good kicking and then boot your nasty arse out of here?
He hasn't got an arse!
Then we'll improvise.
Ghost Finders.
Available now in graphic audio.
Agent Barton, let me remind you that there is no telling what information the Black Widow may have acquired while roaming around up here.
I am aware of that risk.
So you understand why she can't be allowed to leave S.H.I.E.L.D. custody. You know her record, Agent. This isn't someone who's just made a couple of bad choices. This is a woman who is up to her neck in innocent blood.
Is this an order to take her out no matter what she does or says? Because I don't like it, Commander.
I don't like it either, Agent Barton. But I don't think she can be turned, and she certainly can't be allowed to roam free. What choice does that leave us?
Graphic Audio presents Marvel's New Avengers Breakout by Alisa Quitney. Adapted from the graphic novel by Brian Michael Bendis and David Finch.
Our intelligence says the Fantastic Four are out of the country, the X-Men are preoccupied, and the Avengers have called it quits. We believe the time is now.
Spider-Man, you need to wait for backup.
I'm not planning on taking the full tour of the underworld on my own. I'm just scouting around up here to get a picture of what's... Whoa! I'm getting a bad feeling here.
What kind of bad feeling?
The kind that says the evening's probably not gonna end well.
Last night's job isn't done yet. There's still a lot of dangerous criminals out there.
Like I told you, I'm working on it.
Don't think it's a one-man job. Not even a lot of one-man jobs. This is going to take a team effort, Tony.
So, the Avengers are a team again?
I don't know, sir.
And what did you tell Hydra?
I told them it looked like it was happening. Was that the right thing to do?
Yeah.
Welcome to the Savage Land. On behalf of myself and my flight attendant here, we thank you for flying with us today.
If what just happened here was you playing me, then go ahead and shoot.
Of course I was playing you, the same as you are playing me now. I must admit, you're very good. To risk it all just to wrangle a little more information.
Look, I know it's kind of embarrassing, but let's face it. What just happened here, you can't tell me that was part of some plan.
Please, don't insult my intelligence.
We came together at the RAF breakout by chance, or fate, or whatever the hell it was. And then you came up with the idea of making us a team again. It was a good idea. Because the bad guys are working together, that means we need to work together too. They've got mad scientists and shape-shifting super fighters and high-tech experimental weapons and God knows what else. So we need all the help we can get.
Agent Romanova, the Black Widow. I've heard a rumor that you're working with S.H.I.E.L.D. now. Is that true?
Not with S.H.I.E.L.D., Director Fury. With the New Avengers.
Copyright Marvel.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can select from over 900 titles and 60 series in either CD or high-quality download formats. If you would like to listen to an entire series, you can conveniently purchase the whole sets on CD or USB flash drive from graphicaudio.net. At graphicaudio.net, you can now earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable toward future online purchases. You can also get full mobile downloads directly to your phone or tablet with our new Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices, so you can listen on the go, anytime, anywhere. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our email newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.